Welcome back to the program. When asked about the impact of the French Revolution, former Chinese Premier Zhou Enlai once said, "It's too soon to know." Certainly the scope and the stakes of history are always evolving. So too the reputation of the 34th President of the United States. Originally thought to be modest in the wake of the Kennedy excitement of the early 60s, history has come to appreciate the calm, no-drama approach of the Eisenhower presidency and what it actually accomplished. Looking from today's perspective, a band of well-seasoned grown-ups is a pretty attractive prospect in the White House. We're going to talk about the Eisenhower presidency today with my guest, Jim Newton. He's a veteran journalist. He began his career as a clerk to Scotty Reston at the New York Times. Since then, he's worked as a reporter at the Atlanta Constitution, as well as a bureau chief and editor at the Los Angeles Times. It is my pleasure to welcome Jim Newton here to talk about his new book, Eisenhower, The White House Years. Jim Newton, thanks so much for joining us.
I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Great to have you here. One of the things that this book reminds people of is the fact that during the Eisenhower years, it was a time of enormous change that was going on in the country.
It's really true, and I think it's sometimes a sort of lost decade, I think, between the drama of the war of the 1940s and, of course, the upheavals of the 1960s. But the fact is civil rights, feminism, environmentalism, the really profound debate about America's role and responsibility in the world, the Cold War, of course, all of that really runs throughout the 1950s and was a terribly vibrant and energetic decade.
I mean, in many ways, the excitement of the 60s, the protests, everything that happened in the 60s was in many ways a response to, a reaction to, the ferment that had been growing during that period in the 50s.
Yeah, and I think civil rights is really the sort of premier example of that. I mean, again, I think many people associate the civil rights issue and demonstrations with the 1960s, and that's true. But Brown versus Board of Education, of course, is 1954. The Montgomery bus boycotts, the Little Rock crisis in 1957. Those are really pillar moments of the civil rights movement, and they're all in the 50s.
One of the things you talk a lot about is kind of the no-drama approach that Eisenhower brought to the presidency, that he was really looking to tamp down the crisis atmosphere that had been so pervasive for so long.
It's really true, and he really believed that that crisis atmosphere was destructive to the United States, that the American people, and this is part of his kind of bedrock conservatism, that he really believed that the American people, if left to their own devices, were productive and freedom-seeking people, and that they needed the opportunity to exercise those impulses. Now, it's also true that particularly as he struggled with his health, he had a heart attack in 1955 and a stroke the following year, that there was he needed leisure for his own health. So some of this is a manifestation of his sort of personal needs, but I also think there was a larger purpose at work there.
It's hard to think about that in the context of today. I mean, a president taking that much time off, being that focused on his own personal relaxation, probably wouldn't play well today.
Yeah, well, it's true, although I think what's interesting about Ike is that not only did he need that relaxation, but that he was quite pleased to advertise that he did so. And that's, I think, goes to this kind of purpose of trying to sort of calm the country down.
It was also something that was inherent in his personality. It was one of those situations where the times and the man kind of fit together. You talk a lot about the sort of middle way approach of his presidency.
Yes, very much the sort of driving principle, I think, of his presidency is this notion that he had real distrust for what he used to refer to as extremists on either side, and really believed that solutions were found in the center. He was a quite capable compromiser in that sense, and I think in his era, some people saw that as evidence of a kind of lack of ideological conviction, when in fact he really believed that was the key to progress and achieved a lot of progress as a result.
How did his experience in the military prepare him for that middle way approach?
Well, I think there's two ways that his experience in the military really guided his presidency. The first is personal, and that he knew personally virtually every significant Allied leader, whether it was Churchill or de Gaulle or all of those, just growing out of the war. In terms of his pursuit of the middle way, though, I think the most important sort of lesson of his military life that he brought to the presidency was a willingness to delegate serious decisions to subordinates. And there, I think, the preeminent example is in the area of civil rights. Herb Brownell was his attorney general, and Herb Brownell's instincts on civil rights were, frankly, better than Eisenhower's. He is responsible for the appointments of Chief Justice Warren, Justice Brennan, many of the judges who helped implement the Brown decision in the South, Ike's own instincts, I think, were much more incremental on civil rights, but he deferred to Brownell, and because of him, because of that style of leadership, of delegating to subordinates, actually achieved a record on civil rights better than his own instincts.
And yet Eisenhower's own instincts and his own views on civil rights are kind of murky and really didn't seem that strong.
Right, exactly. And I think it's because, that's why I say that I really think that his willingness to defer to Brownell results in a record better than he would have otherwise had. I think that where Brownell saw civil rights much more clearly than Ike did, and because Ike let him take the lead on it, the administration actually ends up accomplishing a great deal, both legislatively and especially through the courts.
And it was Eisenhower's appointment again of Earl Warren that had a profound impact in the civil rights area as well.
Yeah, no question. Eisenhower and Warren would find much to disagree about over the years, and there are instances in which Eisenhower was clearly disappointed in the Warren Court, really less in the area of civil rights than in the areas of domestic security and criminal justice. But the result is, yes, that he does put Warren in that position despite their differences. He respects the court when the court is defied in the Little Rock crisis in 1957. Ike sends in, of course, the 101st Airborne to enforce the orders of the court. So while he had his reservations here and there, he made the right appointments and did the right thing to back him up.
I mean, when you look at the independence and the power of people like Earl Warren, who we talked about, Herb Brownell, John Foster Dulles, I mean, these were not shrinking violets that were part of the Eisenhower administration.
No, it is definitely a team of tough-minded and assertive personalities.
Mm-hmm. Talk about his views as far as the international scene and the Cold War were concerned at this period.
Well, and it's there I think that Eisenhower demonstrates his greatest strength. He understood, I think, better than almost anyone around him that the imperative of the Cold War was to be patient, to understand that ultimately that American values would prevail, to not lurch into a crisis. Time and again, he is advised to use military and even nuclear force to repel an act of aggression of one kind or another, whether it's the Soviets in Berlin or the Chinese in Taiwan or the Viet Cong in Dien Bien Phu. Over and over, his advisors want him to wage war, and over, he understands that patience will serve the United States well and that peace ultimately will prevail. And the result is a really profoundly peaceful record, really, in the Eisenhower years. From the day that he brought the Korean War to an armistice to the end of his presidency, the entire number of American soldiers killed in battles around the world is one, the single Marine who was shot by a sniper in Lebanon. That's a pretty remarkable record of peacekeeping during a very tumultuous period.
How did he see the Soviet Union? I mean, there were stories at the time about deals that were offered to him and Khrushchev wanting to unite Germany that Eisenhower allegedly rejected. What do we know about all of that?
He had a little bit of personal contact with Khrushchev, most famously when Khrushchev visits the United States near the end of the administration. I think he regarded him as someone to be highly wary of. In the early part of the Eisenhower administration, it wasn't really clear who would emerge as Stalin's successor in the Soviet Union. Stalin died a few months after Ike took office. And Ike and his son, John Eisenhower, both were part of the American delegation that met with the Soviet delegation in Geneva in 54. And it's there that they size up the Soviet delegation and really conclude that it's Khrushchev who will emerge. So they got an early beat on him. They regarded him very warily. But they negotiated with him. They did talk to him. And so the style wasn't to cut him off or to shun him, but really to try to engage.
One of the other issues that Eisenhower had to face was extremism within his own party, within the Republican Party, partly McCarthy, Bill Noland here in California with respect to China. How did he deal with that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I would say more often when Ike found serious challenges or serious difficulties with Congress, it tended to come from his right, not his left. McCarthy, of course, is the preeminent example of that. Eisenhower was disgusted by McCarthy and quite criticized in his day for not doing more to engage McCarthy frontally, to take him on directly. Instead, what he practiced is an almost military campaign against McCarthy, which was really to slowly isolate him, cut him off from sources of support, both in Congress and in the media, and in the sort of intelligentsia. And eventually, when McCarthy pushed him too far, Ike invoked executive privilege. He was the first president ever to do so. It's a privilege that he may or may not actually have enjoyed, but he refused to let his subordinates testify about advice they'd given him on the theory that McCarthy had no right to that information. And that began to really cut McCarthy off, and then ultimately, of course, there's the famous confrontation between McCarthy and the lawyer for the Army who asserts that he has no sense of decency, and that's really the beginning of the end of McCarthy.
Mm-hmm. And talk about China and Bill Noland.
Right. Well, then, as you say, Noland and what were known as the China Firsters, who really believe that the United States had done too little to keep communists from taking over in China, constantly, again, urging an aggressive American response to China's forays against Taiwan and others. Again, I think Ike's really profound contribution to the strategy of the period is to cool people off in those crises and to counsel patience and to understand that American security lay not in a direct confrontation but in sort of strategic maneuvering, calming of crises, which he did over and over again.
And that was so effective in so many ways, with the possible exceptions of the coups in Iran and Guatemala.
Right. Yes, it's important to recognize, too, that there's another aspect to this foreign and diplomatic policy, which is while using nuclear weapons to deter a frontal confrontation and negotiations to defuse crises, the administration also believed that it had a responsibility to try to roll back communism where it could. And if you're unwilling to engage it directly, the question is how to do that. And the Eisenhower administration became quite enamored with the idea of covert action. It overthrew Mossadegh in Iran early in the administration, and then quite soon after that, Arbenz in Guatemala. There are profound moral and geopolitical consequences of those decisions, and not positive ones. It seemed to them at the time like a way, as I say, to contain and roll back communism while avoiding a nuclear war, but it had such lasting geopolitical consequences in those countries and in those regions that I think you can say on balance it was more disruptive than they believed at the time and has had lasting consequences.
But theoretically, it also led to the whole notion of the domino theory, which would come later and ultimately to Vietnam.
I guess so. I mean, I don't know that. I mean, I think you're right that the domino theory and covert action grow out of the same impulse, which is that any single nation going can kind of trigger more. The Eisenhower administration didn't practice the domino theory and didn't engage in Vietnam. So I think they are separate lines of reasoning, but you're right that they're overlapping ones.
Talk a little bit about one of the things about Eisenhower. You know, we think of Kennedy as being the first modern president to use television, but Eisenhower used it pretty effectively himself.
He did. I mean, there's a lot of TV images of him. He's the first president, as you know, in the 52 and 56 campaign. He ran with jingles, short ads, understood the kind of shortening attention span that television implied. And then, of course, he himself, he was not a great television performer by any means, certainly not in the mode of Kennedy. But there is a kind of charm to his TV appearances. His farewell address, of course, probably his most famous. There's a kind of intimacy and seriousness about it that he brings to it. So I think he used television in its various aspects more effectively than people recall. And partly they don't recall it because Kennedy was so good at it,
right,
and came immediately on the heels of the Eisenhower administration that Eisenhower seemed like sort of a novice by comparison.
How much of this kind of revisionist take on Eisenhower also comes from the fact that, particularly in the context of today, the prosperity during that period was so strong?
Well, right. I mean, the American economy nearly doubled in output in the Eisenhower years. He inherited about a $10 billion deficit from Truman and left the country with a surplus. He's the last president until Bill Clinton to leave the country with a surplus. So there was a really genuine and important sense of rising tides lifting boats during that period. Now, it's also important to recognize it was uneven. Most of that growth is middle class and white growth, while blacks did not fare as well and others did not fare as well. So it was not altogether a complete success in prosperity, but it was overwhelmingly so.
all during a time when the top tax rate was somewhere around 90%.
Yeah, no, it's really, it is shocking to think about our tax debates today and compare them to those in the Eisenhower years. Eisenhower, throughout his presidency, refused to lower federal income taxes. He lowered a few excise taxes and other things to stimulate the economy out of a couple of recessions. But the top marginal income tax rate in 1960 or 1961 when he left office was the same as it was when he took over, and that was on incomes of on income of $400,000 or more, taxpayers paid 91% in federal taxes.
It's really startling in the context of today's debates.
Yeah, well, I mean, you think about the debate in Washington now is around the question of whether or not to roll back the Bush tax cuts. Those tax cuts lowered the top income tax marginal tax rate from 39.6% to 35%. So, yeah, when you anyone who tries to throw 91% into that debate would just be laughed out of Congress.
It's pretty crazy.
It's something.
Talk about the relationship between Eisenhower and Nixon.
Boy, it's a complicated one. He was genuinely fond of Nixon, supported him very much in 1960, and again in 1968, was quite disappointed when he lost at 60 to Kennedy. And yet never a relationship of equals. Eisenhower very famously during the slush fund scandal where Nixon gives his checker speech saying he's not going to give back the dog that his donors had given his daughters, that speech rallies public support around Nixon, and Eisenhower decides to keep him on the ticket. But when he does so, he greets Nixon in Wheeling, West Virginia, greets him on his plane saying, "You're my boy." And I think that sort of captures a certain something. There's a kind of paternalism in their relationship. Ike, in 1956, encouraged Nixon not to run for re-election for vice president, sort of tried to nudge him off the ticket on the theory, partly that he was interested in running with someone else, but also partly that he thought it would be good for Nixon to go run one of the departments rather than be vice president. Eisenhower had a fondness for business people and a distrust of political people. And he saw Nixon, even though as a loyal and good part of his administration, as a political person. And I think that kept him from regarding Nixon wholly favorably.
It was a huge experience difference, too. I mean, Nixon was this really young politician at the time. And Eisenhower, of course, bringing a world of his own experience to the office.
Right, and I think you put your finger on it exactly when you describe him as a young politician. Those two aspects of his personality in the 50s are such that he's destined not to win Eisenhower's full support. He is young, where Eisenhower is much older, and he's a politician, where Eisenhower is a military person and much more of a person of the world by that point. So I think while he respects Nixon and appreciates him, he also keeps him at arm's length. And then, of course, there's this just tragic moment to the Nixon campaign in 1960 where the press is pressing Eisenhower to give the press an example of something, a big decision that Nixon has made.
Let me think about it.
Yes, and he says, "Give me a week and I'll get back to you." Right? And it really is just a crushing act toward the Nixon campaign. Inadvertent, for sure, and came out worse, I think, than he meant it. But again, it sort of highlights the subordinate role that Nixon played.
Who did Eisenhower want to run with in 56?
He had a whole list of people that he was considering. Most interestingly, the governor of Ohio, who was a Democrat. Hard to imagine how different our politics might be today if Eisenhower had chosen a Democrat to run with him. Also hard to imagine how that would have gone over. But he had a relatively long list. It changed from week to week or month to month as he sort of shuffled it. But he was thinking broadly about who to run with and whether he would run more strongly, whether the country would be better off with someone other than Nixon.
He was also so much more progressive than Nixon in some ways, and certainly progressive by the standards of the Republican Party today.
Yeah, no question. Well, keep in mind, too, though, that Nixon was somewhat more progressive in the 50s than he is when he comes back and runs in 68 with the so-called Southern Strategy, which is really to exploit Southern racism and Southern discomfort with civil rights. So it's true that Ike was throughout more liberal or progressive than Nixon. It's also true that Nixon kind of drifted to his right as he emerged as a presidential candidate.
Also, another area relevant to our discussions today is that Eisenhower, as progressive as he was very clear about wanting a balanced budget.
There's no question about it. People often ask me, how would he regard our politics today? And of course, the answer is that I don't know. But I think that one thing you can say with some certainty is that he would be bothered by the size of the federal deficit. He ran three surpluses in his administration, which is altogether unheard of today. Believed strongly in a balanced budget, not for the ideological reasons that we hear talked about so much today, but because he thought that deficit spending would starve the federal budget of things that he wanted. It was very important to him that we provide a national defense. It was very important to him that there be resources available for public works. He built the interstate highway system. It wasn't cheap.
St. Lawrence Seaway.
He believed in that kind of public project. So he wasn't ideologically committed to balanced budgets so much as he was practically.
Why didn't Nixon use Ike Moore in the campaign in 1960?
Boy, it's an excellent question, and I'm sure he regretted not doing so when he lost so narrowly. Keep in mind, though, part of the Kennedy attack on Nixon was an attack on Eisenhower. There was the sort of meta issue of his campaign was that the administration had become disengaged and detached, and frankly, insufficiently militaristic. That's the so-called missile gap. And that the administration was falling down on the job, and that Nixon was part of that failure. So in that context, it becomes a little bit hard, I think, for Nixon to effectively use Eisenhower, because Eisenhower is part of the line of attack. That said, the decision deprived him of some of the support that Eisenhower enjoyed throughout his presidency, right to the end. And could arguably be said to have cost him that election.
It is interesting in the context of, again, contemporary politics to look back and see Kennedy running really to the right of Eisenhower in some ways, much more as a defense hawk.
Yeah, I think that it's one of those things that history has tended to sort of distort and blur. But yes, the predicate of the Kennedy campaign in 1960 was that we were falling behind in the struggle to contain communism, and that the general who defeated Hitler in World War II was insufficiently aggressive militarily in response to the Soviet Union. And, of course, Kennedy used as a prime example of that the so-called missile gap, that the Soviets were outpacing the United States in the development of nuclear missiles. That was utterly false. Kennedy had some reason to know that it was false. He'd been briefed on it. It's also true that he may not have believed everything he was being told about it by the briefers, but he pursued that strategy, at least with information before him that suggested that it was false.
What did Eisenhower think were the primary accomplishments of his 8 years?
He kept a diary periodically, and he would list accomplishments now and again, and some of the ones he would list were balancing budgets, containing communism without going to war, statehood, interestingly, for Alaska and Hawaii, he was quite proud of, the construction of the highway system and the St. Lawrence Seaway. Those are some of the ones that he often would highlight when he was kind of ticking. I left out what is probably the biggest end in the Korean War.
Talk about the farewell address, because that is one of the most memorable aspects of the Eisenhower presidency.
It is, and one of the things, first of all, let me say that one of the most exciting things for me about the book was midway through the research, there was a discovery of a whole trove of documents related to the farewell address that had been previously lost. They turned up in Malcolm Moose was the principal writer, speechwriter on the farewell address, and he had kept six boxes of memos and drafts and materials about the address. And put them in a boathouse that he owned in Minnesota. They just sat there for decades, and no one knew about them until his son and daughter came upon them one fall while they were cleaning out the boathouse and shipped them off to the Eisenhower Library. So we've learned a lot about the address in recent years, actually in most recent months. It only happened about a year and a half ago. So there's more being learned even today about the address. One of the things that I was most struck by is that the message of the address, the warning of the military-industrial complex and what he called the scientific technological elite, the idea of the cost of the arms race and its sort of crippling burden on American society, some of those ideas were there. He was really talking about throughout his presidency. He gave a very important speech in 1953 to the American Society of Newspaper Editors, where he talked about the cost of the arms race being humanity hanging from a cross of iron, as he put it, quite memorably. So while the farewell address, I think, really crystallized some of those ideas and put them in particularly ominous tones and came from a president at this very poignant moment as he was preparing to leave the service of his country, some of the ideas of it actually reverberate throughout his entire presidency.
It was also counterintuitive as far as Eisenhower was concerned. I mean, here this was a president that had really tried, as we've talked about, to keep crisis at a minimum, to tamp down crisis, then at the end of his presidency kind of laying out what the crises were that we were facing.
It's interesting. I hadn't thought of it in quite those terms, but you're right. I mean, I would say this. He doesn't, the farewell address is delivered in very measured tones. It's a almost somber farewell. It opens with this sort of expression of gratitude to the long service that he's done for his country. Keep in mind, he had, you know, really from the moment he entered West Point, all the way through the end of the presidency, with a very short interlude where he was president of Columbia University, he had essentially been in public service his entire life. So there's a real poignancy about it. But yes, he is definitely saying to the American people, take care. There are things to be worried about here. And principally and most memorably, of course, was the existence of what he called the military-industrial complex, this notion that there was an industry that depended on a certain amount of fear, and that because we could no longer do what we had done in previous generations in his youth, which is to say when there was the threat of war, to convert civilian enterprises into military, building military equipment, because we could no longer afford to do that because conflict would come so quickly, that we now had a permanent arms industry, and that was a new fact of American life and was one, as he would say, to be regarded quite gravely. So he was issuing a very somber warning to the American people as he left, and I think it is something that is profoundly conscious of even today.
The other thing that Eisenhower was able to do, which I guess would be a lot harder for any president to do today, is he maintained this difference between his public and private persona. I mean, he was very calm and, as you say, very sober in public, but had this vicious temper in private.
Yeah, he could really explode. As one aide said, he could peel the varnish off a desk. He would get very mad at people and then very quickly come back to an even temper. But he was not to be taken lightly. He did not suffer mistakes easily. The book is just littered with episodes where he just pops off at one aide or another. So he was not an easy man to work for.
Jim Newton, his book is Eisenhower, The White House Years. Jim, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
It's a real pleasure. I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you.